It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest shares emerging ideas for shaking up the education system in the United States.
First, when we talk about gun violence in the United States, there's often a focus on fatalities, generally around 10,000 deaths a year by gun homicide and 20,000 by suicide. In Wisconsin, there's been a lot of attention to gun deaths in Milwaukee. The number just hit 121, putting the city on a course for the deadliest year in a decade.
As tragic as they are, fatalities are just part of the story. The Centers for Disease Control reports that upwards of 80,000 people suffered gunshot injuries in 2013, the most recent year with data available.
Our next guest wanted to know what's life like after being shot. He's talked to young men in urban neighborhoods about the impacts of a gunshot wound, physically, mentally, and financially.
Ju-Young Lee joins us now. He's assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto and senior fellow in Yale University's Urban Ethnography Project. He's doing research on a book about gunshot wound survivors. Ju-Young, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what led you to this topic of non-fatal gunshot wounds?
So that's probably one of the most common questions I get as a researcher, and I actually became interested in studying non-fatal gunshot injuries while hanging out with aspiring rap artists in Los Angeles. So before I embarked on this long-term study of gunshot victims in Philadelphia, I was spending time in the underground hip-hop scene in Los Angeles, and many of the young men that I was following around and writing about had grown up in neighborhoods in which there was chronic shootings and chronic gang violence between different gangs fighting over turf. And more specifically, one of the main characters from this book that I finished up called Blowing Up Rap Dreams in South Central was shot midway through my research. And at that time, I actually hadn't thought a lot about gun violence aside from the kind of chronic exposures to shootings in one's neighborhood. But this particular individual was shot, and over the years, I watched how this single event transformed his life. I watched how he struggled to adjust to his new body. I watched how this event took him out of the underground hip-hop scene where he was starting to make a lot of waves and pretty much put him out of everyone's radar. And so his experiences really raised a bunch of questions for me as a researcher, and I wanted to know, you know, what's it like for other people who also get shot in inner-city environments? And so after that, I went to a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania that was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And in this position, I was given access to a hospital at the University of Pennsylvania and to an outpatient trauma clinic where I got to meet with people who had been shot in Philadelphia and in the greater Philadelphia region. And so on Friday afternoons, I would go into the outpatient trauma clinic and just talk to people. A lot of people were sitting around waiting to be seen by doctors or specialists, and they had a lot of time to kill. And so nurses would screen people and say, there's a guy here who is very curious about learning about your experiences. Would you like to talk to him? And so we would go from there.
Let's start with the health impact of surviving a gunshot wound. We see the action movies, people are shot. In this scene, two scenes later, they're back to normal. What's it like in the real world? What kind of consequences are there?
Yeah, so one of the main reasons why I also wanted to do this work is that we have a lot of misconceptions, popular misconceptions about what gun violence looks like and also how it affects people. And some of this is definitely shaped by, as you alluded to, these Hollywood movies that make gun violence look a certain way. You know, a lot of the kinds of things we see in movies portrays people being able to, for example, walk through gunfire and portrays people as seemingly impervious to this kind of thing. But the stories that I collected in Philadelphia were very different. They were of people whose lives were basically derailed significantly by the injuries that they suffered in shootings. And so many of the people that I spent time with in Philadelphia were victims who had retained bullets, who had bullets still lodged in their bodies and were uncertain about where these bullets were traveling and if they were going to cause them additional health problems down the road. Other people had colostomy bags and had a whole series of adjustments that they had to make while living with this this bag that was, you know, both shameful and an ongoing health concern. Others had chronic pain. So chronic pain is actually one of the number one health problems faced by non-fatal victims. People who have had retained bullets or who simply just have multiple gunshot wounds often have lingering injuries that transform just their basic sense of being in the world. And so everyday things like brushing your teeth, let alone going to work, can become very difficult and painful.
Talking to sociologist Ju-Young Lee, who's studying the impact of gunshot wounds for survivors. And Ju-Young, adding to the damage there, I assume a lot of the people you're talking to don't have access to a lot of healthcare coverage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one of the main things that we found over the last 20, 30 years in gun violence research is that shootings, both fatal and non-fatal, are not randomly distributed in the U.S. population. We know that they're concentrated most heavily within the most disadvantaged communities of color. And this is true for cities like Milwaukee, places like Philadelphia, St. Louis, and so forth. And so many of the people that I was following did not have access to health care and ended up, you know, I remember one story in particular of a guy who was one of the main first people I met in Philadelphia who had been shot a number of times and who had retained bullets in his body and one of the, had lost the use of his right hand because of nerve damage caused by one of the bullets that entered and exited his body. And, you know, this guy was in just a ton of pain and would go and hustle for pain medications on the streets. And so I spent a lot of time with him when he went into different communities to try and find people who had prescription painkillers like Percocet that could help him stave off some of this pain that had taken over his life. And so one of the things that I really, I guess, learned from this experience was that we sort of know that rehabilitative services are absolutely essential for wounded combat veterans who return from war and other places and whose bodies are damaged badly by gunfire and other kinds of injuries. But the same kinds of ongoing rehabilitative care doesn't exist for gunshot victims in urban poor neighborhoods. And this is a big problem that I'm hoping to address.
We've talked about the physical consequences. How about mental and emotional? This is obviously a traumatic experience.
Oh, definitely. And this is actually one of the hardest things for researchers to really unpack because many people who get shot are living in situations and neighborhoods where it's not common or it's not part of the culture to open up and talk about one's vulnerability. So many of the people who I followed in Philadelphia were young black men who lived in places where being tough and being seen as being tough was a vital part of being a young man, of one's masculinity. And these were places where people are ashamed to admit that they're scared or that they've been frightened or that they're suffering. Now, one of the things that I found was that people who live in these places are exposed to routine situations that sort of re-trigger flashbacks and this sense of trauma. So, for example, one of the victims that I would follow around was shot by somebody who drove a taxi cab in Philadelphia. And every time he saw a taxi cab circling his block, which was multiple times per day, he had this post-traumatic stress reaction where his heart started to race and where he started to feel as if he was under threat. Another person that I follow was out with his friends and family one night, and the story is especially sad because he had been basically socially isolated after he had been shot, and he tried to avoid crowded places and settings in which other people were getting shot or where there were armed robberies or even fights, for that matter. He was out one night with some friends at a bowling alley, and he heard the sounds of bowling pins smashing like during somebody's frame. And this experience re-triggered all of these memories of the night when he got shot and when he thought he was going to die. So these experiences are really hidden because people don't really talk about them that often. And part of my role as an ethnographer, which is what sociologists call somebody who spends a lot of time in a community and writes about people's lives from their perspective, one of my goals was to really try and listen to people and try to immerse myself into their lives so that they would feel comfortable talking about these things.
Ju Young, thanks for sharing their stories and your ongoing research with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ju Young Lee. He's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto and senior fellow in Yale University's Urban Ethnography Project.
Our next guest says it's time to put an end to what she calls the academic rat race. She put her finger on the problem that she sees in the documentary film Race to Nowhere. The film called out an education culture that she says created high-stakes childhood and focused on problems with homework, over-testing, and college admissions.
Now she's got a new book out and a documentary focusing on solutions, highlighting schools and administrators trying to create new models of education. Here's a listen.
Education has become all about filling in a bubble rather than unlocking human potential.
I'm just not learning. I'm just memorizing, and it's really scary.
We need to think completely differently about the fundamental basis of education, why we're doing it, and what it should look like.
Vicki Abeles joins us now. Vicki, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. And so I appreciate you having us.
Your new book and film called Beyond Measure, and this time you're looking at solutions, but I want to back up a little and talk about how you got going on all of this to begin with, and it began with your own three kids and the system that they were going through of education. What was your family life like?
Right. So when my daughters were in middle school, my son was in fourth grade, I started to see the toll that our pressure cooker culture was taking on my kids and on my family. My daughters were then in sixth and seventh grade, staying up until 10 or 11 at night doing homework, waking up in the middle of the night anxious about a test the next day. And at the same time, I didn't feel they loved learning anymore. I really saw that their spark for going to school had changed when middle school started. So I started to speak with parents in my community, with educators in my community, and ultimately with stakeholders across the country. And what I discovered was an epidemic of unhealthy kids who had become disengaged and were showing up unprepared later on in college and the workplace. And so I set out to create a film that shared that story and called on all of us to redefine success in our schools and our communities. And that film, as you just said, is Race to Nowhere. It's been seen in more than 40 countries to millions of people and has become kind of an enduring touchstone for educators, parents, and students who are interested in creating something better. And Beyond Measure is the next step in our work, featuring solutions driven by individuals and communities who believe in their collective power to change the system, not just the symptoms.
Well, let's start with one of the areas that you're looking at and changes, homework. And there has been pushback from some parents nationally about the amount of homework the kids can get. First off, what do we know about how effective homework is for learning?
Well, I think that the research is pretty clear that in elementary school there's no benefit to homework, and even in middle and high school there's a point of diminishing returns when there's too much. And I think that's what we're seeing across the country, is that our kids are coming home to a second or third shift of homework after spending 7 hours in school. And so it's not leading to good learning outcomes, and it's also impacting their health. We've got an epidemic of sleep-deprived kids, where 80% of children and teenagers are getting less than the sleep that they're recommended, by about 2 hours a night. And I think that sleep deprivation is leading to kids who are showing up in school less prepared to learn, and also contributing to the epidemic that we're seeing in terms of anxiety, stress, and depression.
One of the arguments.
The good news is. The good news is there are lots of individuals who are working to change this. And so our book features stories of schools across the country that are taking a different approach. For example, a principal in Gaithersburg, Maryland, who decided that she was going to take traditional homework off the table for her elementary school students and instead create a culture of readers. A principal in Oakland, California at Hillcrest School took a similar approach. You've got teachers who are experimenting with reducing homework and allowing time during class and during the school day for individuals to be supported in their learning, to have the opportunity to practice.
We're talking with Vicki Abeles right now. She's a filmmaker, author, and advocate for changing the American education system. Her latest book and documentary are called Beyond Measure, Rescuing an Overscheduled, Overtested, and Underestimated Generation. And Vicki, just to stick with homework for a little longer, one of the arguments that you hear for homework is that when you get to high school, you do need to put in more time doing it, so you can't really start cold, and that practicing in elementary school and in junior high is part of the practice that's necessary for success in high school for the homework that helps there. What do you think about that argument?
I think that's a myth. I go back to something David Elkind, who in my view is kind of the grandfather of this movement, said that, you know, and that kind of is the assumption that in order to prepare for a bad experience, and let's just say maybe high school homework is a bad experience for many students, particularly when we're talking about 3 to 5 hours a night, is the best way to prepare for that is to have lots of good experiences leading up to that. We've filmed and had conversations at schools throughout the country, high schools that see students who are showing up who have been burdened by homework in middle school, who are showing up less prepared, less enthusiastic about their learning than students who attended schools where there was no homework in middle school. So I think that's largely a myth, that in order to prepare for the workload, you have to do more of it at younger and younger ages. You know, one of the things that I think is particularly ironic is that our kids get to college where they may end up in class 10 to 15 hours a week versus high school that is typically 35 hours a week for a student. And the homework load is about the same. The outside of class load is about the same in college, but they have many more hours to get that work done because they're not, in effect, putting in a full week just attending class.
Well, let's look now at standardized testing, and again, a national pushback about standardized testing in public schools. We've seen the birth of the opt-out movement, parents who say their kids can be excused from some of these standardized tests. What sort of effect do you think standardized testing is having on kids and their education right now?
Yeah, so I think that the constant testing of the last few decades has really changed the character of education, and it's another contributor to our kids' epidemic of anxiety and depression. And I think it's a mistake to focus on data and equate test scores with quality, with learning, or with preparation.
And you want schools that are recreating what education looks like in America, and I'm gathering that would include less standardized testing. What would they look like, though? What are some of the schools who are really the shining stars in a new movement, as you see it? What are they doing right?
Right. So we feature many of those schools in our new film. These innovative schools and models are about putting the emphasis on the learning and the student experience. Oftentimes these models look like students who are learning by doing rather than memorizing for a test. They're about growth. They're about experimentation, about creativity, about cultures that encourage and foster collaboration. And I think the research is really clear that learning through these methods as opposed to the memorization of formulas and concepts better prepares kids for long-term success.
You have a quote in your film from education expert Ken Robinson, and he makes the point, he believes that change in education has to come from the ground up, not from the top down. Is that what you're seeing as you made this film? Are you seeing individual schools taking this on instead of something that's being initiated at a national level?
Well, I think that many of us have assumed that change in education needs to come from the top down, and both our film and our book, and certainly Sir Ken Robinson, challenged that assumption. And so we are seeing a revolution brewing in schools across the country. The change is being driven by educators, it's being driven by parents, it's being driven by students. And so I think that, you know, layers of change are needed to create a system that better prepares kids for their future while also nurturing their individual talents right now during childhood. And that change, as I said, can happen at many different levels, and many different stakeholders can drive that change. And I think it starts by bringing people together to create a shared vision for what it is they desire for the kids in their community.
And Vicki, we're almost out of time here, but just very briefly, you know, the public education system in America is massive. How hopeful are you for the kind of change that you'd like to see?
I'm really hopeful. I think that we're at a unique time with the presidential election coming up. There's a movement, as you just pointed out, of a lot of parents opting kids out of tests. I think that we're in a really good place for innovation, and my hope is that this book, with the stories of changemakers in our schools and the film, which paints a picture of what's possible in our schools when we put students and their learning at the center of our decision-making, I'm very hopeful.
Vicki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Vicki Abele. She's a filmmaker, author, and advocate for overhauling the American education system. Her latest book and its accompanying documentary are called Beyond Measure. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, the latest on the legal battle over what counts as voter ID here in Wisconsin.
First, Wisconsin is one of just 9 states that treat 17-year-old offenders as adults. That means that 17-year-olds in the state charged with nonviolent offenses, things like theft or underage drinking, have to face the prospect of adult court and adult correctional facilities.
But a group of lawmakers is looking to change that now. A second chance bill proposed by Republican State Senator Jerry Petrosky and others would reverse course on changes made to state law in 1996 and allow 17-year-olds facing a first-time nonviolent offense to be tried in juvenile court.
Shireen Seward joins us now to talk more about the proposal and how we got to this point. She's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Shireen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with a new proposal. What exactly would it do?
Basically, it's going to ensure that 17-year-olds who are charged with nonviolent first-time offenses are treated as juveniles. They'd move back into juvenile court, where now, whether it's shoplifting or underage drinking, they do have to go to adult court and adult corrections. So this changes that considerably. What it does not do, though, is take the power out of prosecutors' hands to try those people, those teens as adults for very serious crimes.
And this looks to be a rare piece of legislation that seems to have bipartisan support. Who's behind it?
Actually, the bill has 71 bipartisan co-sponsors this session. This is the second time that they've tried to pass this. Last time they had 54. So there is some optimism that that this will pass this time around.
Now, just to look back a bit, the current system goes back to 1996. What was the rationale then for making 17-year-olds at that point take part in the adult system?
Sure. You know, pretty much throughout American history, juvenile offenders have been treated differently than adults. And juveniles, they try to increase emphasis on rehabilitation. But there was a jump in juvenile crime that happened in the late 80s, early 90s, that sparked some pretty significant nationwide fears about this generation of super predator youth that were preying on our society. You might remember the Central Park jogger case in 1989. That was a big one. But Wisconsin's tough on juveniles approach really happened in 1991. There was an 11-year-old boy who shot and killed a 21-year-old man in Racine. He couldn't be charged in adult court because of his age, and that spurred this on. Racine County Circuit Judge Dennis Berry really spearheaded this effort to help revise the Juvenile Justice Code because he and many others felt that it did not adequately protect victims of the public. So then this law moving jurisdiction of all 17-year-olds to adult court was passed by the state legislature and took effect in 1996.
So what do we know about what happened since then? What has the impact been?
Well, it's interesting because since then there's been a steady decrease in juvenile crime across not only Wisconsin but the United States, and kind of this worry about a generation of super predators never really materialized. And then there's been some studies that show that maybe this isn't the best way to go.
And in terms of the differences, what happens differently in juvenile court that does not happen in adult court for these first-time offenders?
Well, in an adult system, the children are not they're not given educational opportunities. It's really all about. It's a different kind of situation. Plus, you've got to remember that the parents are not involved then. So if your 17-year-old child is arrested for, let's say, you know, even shoplifting, the police don't have to call you. They could legitimately go through the entire court system, and you wouldn't even know. This puts it back into the parents' hands. It keeps parents involved, and that can really be a key part of the process.
Is the emphasis more on rehabilitation and in sort of community service than it would be in adult court?
Yes, absolutely. So there are different services that are available for juvenile offenders that really help change their thinking, and there is significant research that shows that youth at this age are quite capable of learning new ways of thinking and behaving if they go through these rehabilitative programs. And so these counties around the state are starting to implement these programs that are proving to be successful in getting the youth back on track.
We're talking with reporter Shereen Seward right now about a new legislative proposal that would keep 17-year-olds who are facing nonviolent offenses out of adult court and adult correctional facilities. And Shereen, looking at other states as an example, what do we know about recidivism rates when 17-year-olds are funneled to juvenile court instead?
Actually, recidivism rates are much better for 17-year-olds that are in the juvenile system. There is what we can see from data, 17-year-olds in adult court are twice as likely to return to prison. So, I mean, they really, there's been study after study after study that shows that this is the case. Now, it's not going to work for every teen, but certainly, you know, juveniles seem to have a better shot at making a go of it and having a clean start when they are dealt with in the juvenile system.
Now, other states are part of this. There are 9 states like Wisconsin who have 17-year-olds being funneled to adult court. But is there a move now, a national move, to do what Wisconsin might be doing with this law and try 17-year-olds in the juvenile system instead?
Yes. And many states have already gone back to the system. Illinois did it recently. Connecticut did it recently. So we're not alone in this kind of thinking. It's kind of been a process over the last, I'd say, 8 years, where one by one states are starting to return to the old model of sending those 17-year-olds back to juvenile corrections programs.
Now, it sounds like Outagamie County has tried this model as a sort of a trial. What happened?
Actually, they tell us that this program has been very successful. Outagamie County officials implemented this program last year. It's a pilot program that offers nonviolent first-time 17-year-old offenders services that would be typically available only to juveniles. So once these teens fulfill those program requirements, prosecutors can close their case files. They can dismiss the criminal charges. And, you know, this helps the 17-year-olds who now don't have that adult criminal conviction. They're better able to go to school, to get jobs. And so far, the people who are in charge of this program have been very optimistic. It's still a work in progress, but the vast majority of those teens are doing very well.
Why was Outagamie County able to do that if it's not state law?
You know, that is something that a county program can be created, but from a statewide perspective, that would take legislation.
And so you said this didn't pass last time around. Is this time looking to be different?
Well, according to the folks at the State Bar of Wisconsin, they're backing this legislation. They tell me that they are optimistic about this because of the number of co-sponsors. They feel this has a much better chance of passing than it did in March.
We're talking right now with reporter Shireen Seward about a new legislative proposal that would keep 17-year-olds in juvenile court, in the juvenile system, instead of being tried in adult court.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you think 17-year-olds who have committed non-violent offenses should be treated as juveniles as opposed to adults, which they currently are? What would you see as the benefits or drawbacks of making that change? If you work in the criminal justice system, or if you've been through it yourself, what do you think about all this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Shireen Seward from the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. We're hearing about a new legislative proposal with bipartisan support. It would allow 17-year-olds who are facing non-violent offenses in Wisconsin to be tried as juveniles instead of as adults, which is currently the case.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Would you support this change, or do you think that things should stay the way that they are? If you work in the criminal justice system, what have you seen and what questions do you have? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Shireen, public safety has been a part of this discussion since 1996 and earlier. What sorts of measures are in place to make sure that there is no public safety concern here that's attached to this legislation?
Well, it's important to remember that this proposal is aimed at nonviolent offenses. So there is already in place legislation that shows any juvenile over 10 years old who is charged with homicide or attempted homicide, they're automatically tried in adult court. That's not changing. There's also a list of about 70 offenses that are not included here. So children who are charged with violent offenses, violent sexual offenses, for example, would not go to juvenile court. So the public still has that measure of protection because those things haven't changed.
And sexual assault, you brought up that example. You said nonviolent sexual assault, but sexual assault in general, is that something that is... How is that considered?
Well, aggravated criminal sexual assault, aggravated battery with a firearm, those kinds of things, those would stay in adult court.
And has there been pushback against the idea of charging violent youthful offenders as adults? Is that something that is on the table for discussion at all of this?
You know, this bill does not address that, and I suspect that there will have to be a conversation about that sometime in the future. Of course, there has to be a punishment that fits the severity of the crime, and we've seen that in a couple of cases here in Wisconsin, a lot of debate about that. But, this is a step, at least, toward changing this system. And I do know that there have been some cost concerns that have probably held this up in the past, and those things are going to have to be talked through.
You can join our conversation right now as we talk about a new proposal that would treat 17-year-olds with first-time nonviolent offenses in juvenile court, not in adult court. This is a change starting in 1996. 17-year-olds in that position were funneled into adult court. So this would be a big change here in Wisconsin, or at least a change. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think 17-year-olds who have committed nonviolent offenses should be treated as juveniles as opposed to adults? And what do you see as the benefits or maybe the drawbacks of making that change? And if you work in the criminal justice system, what have you seen in your job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, is there any sort of counterbalance to this movement that you're talking about, Shireen, of 17-year-olds, nonviolent offenders being treated in juvenile quarters? Is there anyone who's sort of saying the opposite right now at this point in history?
Well, I haven't seen states that are going the other way. But as far as objections to this bill, of course, there are people who think, okay, these 17-year-olds, they know what they're doing. They should be treated like adults. There are going to be those people. And there is some concern over the cost. Sending a 17-year-old to a juvenile correctional facility costs significantly more than sending them to an adult facility. accessibility. So that has been an issue. But then on the other hand, if you're reducing recidivism and you're reducing offense rates, that can yield some pretty significant increases in our state's economic productivity each year. So so those things are all on the table right now.
We'll go to our callers right now. We've got Ruth with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Hi. You know, there's a lot of research to support this decision not to put adolescents, 17-year-olds, actually adolescents in general, but 17-year-olds here specifically, in through the adult system, that your recidivism rate, as your speaker is saying, is much higher, and the cost of that over time, both the human cost, the family cost, the taxpayer cost, are huge. And, you know, you mentioned we have a tradition of doing this. Well, we have a tradition of not doing this. We have a short history of doing this, and it's not panned out very well. And, you know, we need to listen to our own common sense here and also the research that is deep and wide that this should be changed in our state.
Ruth, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And Shireen, your take?
Yeah, I've read the same kinds of studies. There's study after study that shows that, you know, 17-year-olds dealt with in the juvenile justice system are less likely to reoffend by a lot. And so you do have to look at the cost savings, both in human and monetary costs, in a long-term manner, you know, through that long-term lens. And long-range, are you going to save money? I think so, based on the estimates that I've seen, and lower societal and prison costs in general.
Now, there has been some research the past several years about the brains of teenagers, and some researchers finding that the teenage brain is more impulsive. It's still in process. It's not a fully mature brain yet. I wonder if any of that has entered into these discussions that you've seen.
Yes, actually it has. Brain and developmental research shows that, you know, youth at this age, they're more impulsive. That impulsivity tends to recede as time goes by. So the 17-year-old brain, very different from the 25-year-old brain, for example. And because of that, youth at this age are more capable of learning new ways of thinking. They're more open to corrective behavior.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Kevin joining us next in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. One comment, one question. Comment, I would be very supportive of this. I would much rather see tax-paying adults than tax-supported prisoners. And you just touched on my second point. My question is, given what we know about brains, do we need maybe like a young adult court system for 17 to 22-year-olds to take these kinds of issues into account? And I'd be happy to take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Interesting, Kevin. Thank you for that. Right. I'm not sure. I'm not up on the latest research about when the brain might reach maturity, but that's an interesting proposition, a young adult court. Have you heard anything about that, Shireen?
Boy, I have not, and that is an interesting proposition. I have seen research that shows that the brain matures by about age 25. So you know, what he's saying might be worth talking about, and that's something that perhaps legislators will take a look at as well. I don't know.
Any other kind of model like that you've seen anywhere else in the country, or would that be a new thing?
Boy, I have not seen anything like that. And there could be something, but nothing that turned up in my research.
Well, thank you so much for that, Colin. We're going to move on to John joining us in Milwaukee at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Hi, John.
Hi. I know you're running out of time, so I'll try to be brief. I benefited back in the late 60s from a program over in Michigan called the Youthful Trainee Program. I had just turned 18, and I did something very stupid. It was a felony. But under that program, as long as I didn't do anything else stupid over a period of time, kept my nose clean, my entire record was wiped clean. I got fingerprints back, the whole ball of wax, and I was able to go on to become a productive citizen. I'm a community leader now, but for the grace of God. You know, had I been subjected to the adult prison system, who knows where I would be now. I got a second chance. 17-year-olds, you know, at that age, they're stupid. They do stupid things. If it's a nonviolent violation of the law, they need every break they can get. To put them into the adult system is criminal, I honestly believe. The law needs to be changed.
John, thank you so much for that. Where did you say that was again?
That was in Michigan.
In Michigan.
Youthful Training Act. I don't know if the law is still in effect now or not, but back in 1969, it was, and it saved my life.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling with that perspective. And I'm wondering, as legislators consider this, Shireen, are they hearing from people like John?
I would imagine so. I think that they've listened to their constituents about this, and that's making an impact.
Thank you so much for that, John. And we go next to Mike. Mike joins us from Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm in agreement with this proposed change. I think we're handicapping our youth and our treat these minor cases in adult court. It goes right on CCAP. It goes right on their record. It's searchable by any hiring manager from California to Florida and everywhere in between. And when you're faced with the last two candidates, all you need to do is sit at your desk, type in that person's name, and up pops some minor offense. Well, gee, I'm going to go with the other candidate from another state. I think it's a good first move, and I think getting these kids treated as the youth that they are is a smart thing to do.
All right, we'll leave it there, Mike. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. We're going to go right to Nate. Nate joins us next in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, I'd just like to mention that when I was 16, I got a felony for burglary and credit card fraud, and my accomplice was 17, and our lives diverged completely because he was charged as an adult and I was charged as a minor. Basically, I got 6 months probation, and everything was fine after that. He got about a year in prison, and the difference between me and him, of course, life choices are different for everybody, but I went to college, I got a degree, I have a good job up here in Milwaukee, and he's kind of struggled ever since, so I just want to throw that out there.
Nate, thank you. So I really appreciate calling in with that story and that example. And Shireen, do you think that this is something, this sort of story, is going to sway the legislature in Wisconsin as they look at this issue and how they might proceed?
I suspect it will. And it's important that they think about those things and take that into consideration. Yes, it can dramatically change someone's life. A mistake at 17 is not the same as a mistake at 30. It's not, and these are not repeat offenders we're talking about either. I mean, once they've already committed a crime, they're not eligible for this kind of consideration under this plan.
And going forward, do we have a timeline on how soon we could see action on this legislation?
Well, it's in committee right now, so it's been referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety, where it is right now. I expect that we will be hearing more about it in the coming weeks.
Well, Shireen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Shireen Seward, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. She joined us to talk about a new legislative proposal that would allow 17-year-olds who are facing first-time nonviolent offenses in Wisconsin to be tried as juveniles and not as adults.
You can keep sharing your thoughts on that issue over at the Central Time Facebook page. Join the conversation while you're there.